The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's a pleasure to be back here at the Philadelphia Free Public Library. This is my fourth or possibly my fifth time here talking about one of my books. It's a pleasure to be here for a lot of reasons, not least of which is that I actually love libraries very deeply. I kind of grew up in libraries, hanging out at the library after school. I'm actually writing a book, which we can talk about in the question and answer period if you like, based on a lecture that I've given a few times. The lecture is called Democracy's Choice, Books or Bumper Stickers, my publisher doesn't think much of that as a title for a book, so the book is evidently titled What Democracy Needs Now, which I guess has more of the urgent selling name, but I like the other one, the other title better. It is a pleasure to be here to talk about my novel, Jericho's Fall. Before I read from it, I'm only going to read for a very brief passage, only three or four pages. I want to tell you a couple of things about it and things that have come up already. I'm nearly at the beginning of my book tour, which is probably why I feel relatively awake. Everyone says book tours are shorter this year than they've been in the past because of the economy, but I feel mine is 4 weeks, so I feel like it was only 3 weeks last year, so I think mine may actually be a little bit longer. A couple of things I want to mention about the book. The first thing is I heard from a reporter that some of the early reviews of the book said that my protagonist, Rebecca DeFord, known as Beck, is white. And the reporter said that when she read the book, she took Beck DeFord to be black. And she said, would I clear this up? And I said, no, I wouldn't. I said in the age of Obama, what difference does it make whether the protagonist is white or black? But it's really interesting that my other three novels, it's true, have been set very explicitly within the borders of what in my work I refer to as the darker nation, what I called in my novels and in my short stories that I write as well. And this one takes place in the Colorado Rockies, and my protagonist, Beck, is never actually described in the book, which drove the copy editor half nuts, I might add. But the protagonist is never described, and I did that intentionally. Let me say there are some clues in the book. There's, in addition to being, I hope, it's a mystery and a thriller in its own right, but also there are clues in the book to Beck's actual race, but they're only clues. And if you don't choose to look for them, it doesn't really matter, because I hope you can enjoy the book in any case. It's just interesting to me that if you don't say what race someone is, the default in literature is the assumption that the person is white. Toni Morrison actually talks about this a little bit in her book Whiteness and Literary Imagination. It's actually about something else. It's not really about that problem, but she does refer in passing to that notion of the default in literature and what it really is. In any case, whether you think Beck is black or white or anything else, I think you should be able to enjoy the book in any case. That's one thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say about it, Jericho Ainslie, who is the title character in the book, and you already heard in the introduction that when the book begins, he's dying, and he's summoned Rebecca to his bedside, and they had a scandalous love affair some years before the book began when she was his student. He was on sabbatical from the CIA teaching at Princeton. She was his student, and they had an affair that ended his marriage and his career. And one of the reasons that he was on sabbatical was he was being eased out of the CIA because he was showing signs of mental instability. So I tell you that because people often ask, what's the impetus? How did you come up with this character? And the truth is, when I wrote my previous novel, Palace Council, which is set in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, And a lot of it takes place in Vietnam. I did a lot of research at that time about the Central Intelligence Agency and some of the other American intelligence agencies. And it's really quite interesting when you do the research that there are a number of famous stories or infamous stories about mental instability at even the top ranks of American intelligence. I don't make the claim at all that people in intelligence work are somehow more likely to be mentally unstable than other people. I don't believe that, and there are no data to support that. I think that most people who work in the intelligence area, like most people who work in anything else, are good people trying to do a very difficult job. But I do think that when you do have problems of instability, they have a higher cost. That's the thing. And so, for example, the very famous case of James Angleton, who was head of counterintelligence for many, many years, and yet spent at least the last decade of his life not only alcoholic, but also in a growing paranoia that was so great that he began to suspect anyone put into a job above him of being a mole for the KGB, and indeed nearly blew up the Soviet section of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was moribund for a number of years, partly as a result of the things that he did. So the cost can be very, very high. I've been doing a lot of research. I'm actually writing an article about the question of mental illness and intelligence work. There's a lot of people who have written about this over the years. There are a lot of facts we do know about very high rates of divorce, for example, among people who work on the covert side especially, and various other things as well. That was part of the inspiration for the book. But there's another half also, which is something that I really learned from the work of Joyce Carol Oates, which is that we have a lot of these famous scandals with these famous, almost always men, and a young woman somewhere, and the man's career, sometimes it survives, sometimes it's ruined, and we follow him in the news. And Joyce Carol Oates pointed out the women kind of disappear. The young women, we don't know what happens to them. Somehow they're not important to the story. And I think they're the more important part of the story. And so in writing this, I was interested really, why tell it from the point of view of Beck? And the reason is because that's the point of view we don't hear very often. People ask me, well, they say, if this is told from the point of view of a woman, isn't that a very difficult thing for you as a writer, as a male writer, to do? Of course it is. Of course it's difficult. But if you care about writing, if you take your writing seriously, every narrative voice is difficult. It's never easy to come up with a consistent voice and make it and make it work. And if people do find it easy, they're probably writing literature of let's say moderate quality, I think is the way to think about it. It was very hard work. I hope that I pulled it off successfully, that if you read the book, you'll be the judges of that. Anyway, I'm going to read from just the very beginning of the novel. I'm going to answer in advance a couple of the most frequently asked questions about it, and then I'll be happy to take questions from the audience. I have been asked to advise you that there are going to be microphones, or at least one microphone, maybe multiple, I don't know how many there are, but whatever the number may be, you're asked to please wait for the microphone to approach you before you begin to ask your question so that everyone will hear you. If you ask your question and you don't wait for the microphone, I will feel free to rephrase your question into the one I wish you'd asked instead. So I'm going to read you from the very beginning of my novel, Jericho's Fall. On the Sunday before the terror began, Rebecca DeFord pointed the rental car into the sullen darkness of her distant past. The interstate was behind her. So was the chilly rain that had slowed her progress. The county road wound through thick Colorado forest, now snuggling along mountain peaks, now twisting among glowering trees. Here and there, a distant flicker marked a farmhouse, then was gone. Fog enclosed her like sudden blankness. There was no moon. There were no stars. Street lamps had overlooked this corner of America, and so had the programmers of the car's GPS. The road was curvy and unkempt, and in mid-April, icy in places. Still, Rebecca drove very fast, the way she always did. She did not know whether she was running away or running toward. She was 34 years old, and for most of her life, it felt as if she were running sideways, a cheerleader watching others play the game. She had grown accustomed to her role and hated to be dragged onto the field. She had not wanted to make the journey, but she had no choice. Jericho Ainslie was dying, and although hardly anybody remembered nowadays exactly what Rebecca and Jericho had been to each other, everybody agreed that they had once been something. Beck herself had trouble recalling the precise details of their 18 months together, even though once upon a time she had given interviews about it. "Come on," she urged the pokey car that struggled up the slope. Like many lonely people, Beck was on terms of easy conversational familiarity with the objects around her and often with herself. "Come on, you can do this. Don't quit on me." The car seemed to grumble back at her. "It's okay," patting the dashboard as its screens glowed sullen rebuke. "It's okay, you can do this." The car finally upshifted and picked up the pace. Rebecca smiled, although another part of her would happily have missed the trip entirely. Jericho was not supposed to die, not yet. He and Beck were supposed to, what? Reconcile, apologize, have an ordinary human conversation? There was some ceremony left anyway, and they were supposed to have all the time in the world to perform it. "Guess not," she muttered. Beck had learned of Jericho's condition not from his family, but from an enterprising reporter who had tracked her down in Boston. The reporter called not the BlackBerry she used for business, but her personal cell, a number known to perhaps a dozen people. It was Saturday. She liked weekends because the stores were crowded and you could observe the flow of customers looking for bottlenecks and underused spaces. "I'm updating Ambassador Ainsley's obituary," the reporter had shouted because Rebecca was walking the sales floor and could hardly hear over the din. "Not the national security angle," the reporter explained. "The personal side, the scandal, in case he dies this time." And wondered whether she would care to comment. Beck had said something rude and unprintable. Hanging up, she had called the house, the number she never forgot, although she had not used it in years. She feared and half hoped the number had been changed, but Audrey answered on the second ring and said that Jericho had been asking for her, Audrey, who never went anywhere. If Audrey was at the bedside, things are grim indeed. "The doctors have surrendered," Audrey said. "My father's future is in God's hands," she added, who preached that all things were. Beck promised to come at once. At once proved complicated. She arranged for her conniving deputy to take over the semi-annual inspection tour of the 19 New England stores owned by the retail conglomerate that employed her, then called her boss, an acerbic little man called Pfister, who grumbled and fussed and told her that this was a really lousy time to take family leave. Had Rebecca finished college, she would be Pfister's boss rather than the other way around. They both knew it. He scolded her all the harder as a result. But when Rebecca for once stood her ground, Pfister, astonished at his own generosity, told her that she could have 3 days, no more. He needed her back in time for the regional manager's meeting, set to begin Friday morning in Chicago. Beck promised she would be there. Actually, she would not. By Friday, Rebecca DeFord would be running for her life. So that's the prologue of the story. I hope it whet your appetite a little bit. I want to answer a couple more of the most commonly asked questions before turning to your questions and discovering whether, as one of my other stops briefly did, this turns into a discussion about the Supreme Court confirmation process instead of about my book. I'm hoping that it won't. Someone asked, and there's no polite way to put this. He said, "Well, this book is so much shorter than your other books. Why is that?" And I couldn't tell from the tone if he was merely curious or if he preferred them shorter, if he preferred them longer. And the answer, I suppose, the answer every writer gives, it's as long as it has to be. But there's another answer, too. When I decided to write this book, I was actually supposed to be writing an entirely different novel, which I'm still writing. It's coming out next, I think we just decided it's coming out next June. But I woke up one morning in late summer or early fall of last year with the basics of this story firmly in my head. I have no idea where it all came from. I'd been thinking about the stay. I'd been writing about some of these other issues. And I woke up and I had this story in my head. And I worked 2 days. I couldn't get it out of my head. I called my agent. I called my editor. I said, "I want to write this book instead and postpone the other book." And they said, "Not on your Nelly," they said. But I finally persuaded them that I was going to do this one first, and it came pretty fast and pretty easy. I wrote this book in about 8 weeks, and I don't write like that. That's very unusual for me. I take years, and it's agony to write. It's just agony. This book was not agonizing. This book was fun
to write. I don't know why, but I had a lot more fun with it. As to why it's also shorter, I think there's another reason, though. All the action in this book takes place either in this little Colorado town or in Jericho Ainslie's house or on the grounds above the town. There is a closeness to the area in which it takes place. And so the book feels nicely rounded, I think, in that sense. A thriller that's set in that kind of space shouldn't be 650 pages long. So this is 350 pages long, and my previous shortest novel, I think, was 530 or 520 or something like that. But it wasn't. I didn't set out to say, let me write a shorter novel. I just had this story in my head, and it took the time that it took. And like all my novels, this one began with the characters. I wanted to write about this man, this figure who began to take shape in my head, who became Jericho Ainslie, and this woman for whom he'd thrown away his career, but of course her life had been ruined. He sits up on his mountaintop writing books about foreign policy and feeling very bitter about how he was treated, and she's kind of drifted from job to job and never went back to school after that. And much of the book is, in certain ways, a contest of wills between the two of them. She was very much the dominant, he was very much the dominant character in their relationship, and now they're meeting again 15 years on, and she's grown up. And the power relationship, you quickly realize, is a little bit different than it was at that time. So that's one question I get, is about that aspect. Another question that comes up a lot when I, especially when I've talked to reporters about this book, people have said to me that your books seem to be inspired by the headlines. That is to say, here's a book about the CIA, and of course the CIA is in the news. My first novel was about a Supreme Court confirmation fight. My second novel was about a presidential election with two people who've been to the same college, and so on and so on. But I say some of that is intentional, some of it is coincidence. The truth is, if you write a book, the CIA is always in the news. You know, it's not as though you write a book at the CIA and say, oh, people have forgotten about the CIA by next year. That's going to be such old news. You can always bet on that one, so that takes no prescience at all. And as I've pointed out to reporters, my book about the two presidential candidates who had known each other in college came out after the 2004 election, not before. So I couldn't possibly have been anticipating it, no matter what people might think. And and my book about the Supreme Court confirmation process came out in a roughly 4-year period when there were no vacancies on the Supreme Court. So actually, I'm not either anticipating or following the headlines. I just am writing things that seem interesting, and sometimes they happily coincide with other external events, and sometimes they don't. The other question I get consistently is, given that I'm also a full-time law professor, which do I like better? That is, I write a lot of nonfiction. I've written 7 nonfiction books. I write a lot of articles. I write a lot of op-eds. I do some blogging. I do various other things. People ask me, which do I like more, writing fiction or nonfiction? The truth is, I like them both. I just like putting words on a page. It's the only thing I have that I can do better than most people, is put words together on a page. I don't have any other marketable skill, and it's been a great blessing that people will pay me to do that, because I don't know what I would do otherwise. And when I sit down at my laptop, I'm kind of indifferent as to whether the next thing I write is going to be fiction or nonfiction. Someone asked me at dinner what I'm working on now, and my laptop is sitting in my hotel room. I'm going to go work tonight when I get back there, and there's 5 things open on it right now. There is one novel, next year's novel, is open on it. There is a short story that is open on it. There's this article I'm working on about, that I mentioned to you about, mental instability and intelligence work is open on it. And that's 4. There's something else open on it. I can't remember. Is that 3? That's 3. There's 2 other things open on it, too, but I don't remember what they are. But there's 5 different things open on it, because when I get bored with one thing, I just go and work on something else. In that sense, I suppose I have a kind of undisciplined working style. It's rare for me to make myself finish something. But I just enjoy writing. It's something I really, really like. My wife could tell you that there are days, especially in the summer when I do most of my writing, there are days when I get up, if I'm not on book tour, I usually get up about 6 o'clock and I have my breakfast, do some Bible reading in the morning, and then sit down and sit at my laptop. My wife says there are days when she doesn't see me again until dark. You know, that even though my study is right on the first floor by the front door, I lose track of everything that's going on around me when I'm writing. And I don't know why exactly that is, but I am transported by it. I really enjoy doing it. And if I were forced to choose, I don't know how I could ever choose between the writing I do as a scholar and the writing I do as when I write fiction. Certainly, writing fiction is more lucrative than writing scholarly books, but it's not more fulfilling. It's not more fulfilling. I happen to enjoy them. I enjoy them both. And when I say it's more lucrative, you know, I did do 7 nonfiction book tours. I'll be doing another one probably next fall. And, you know, when you do nonfiction book tours and you write the kind of books that I do, what my sister-in-law refers to as the everybody's entitled to my opinion kind of book, there's 3 things that happen. One is you get very small crowds. Usually 5 or 6 people come. The other thing is that 4 of them usually work for the bookstore. And the other thing is they're all angry. And they haven't read the book. They know nothing about me, but, so for example, I've written 3 books about law and religion or religion and politics. And when you tour the book of religion and politics, you attract people who are really angry about religion and politics. They might be on the right, they might be on the left, but they are really angry. They don't know who I am, they don't know anything about the book, but they are there to make a point. And by God, they are going to make their point. And that's what your book signing is like if you do write the kind of, and so fiction is more fun to tour. I will say that. The book tours are much more fulfilling. Anyway, I want to thank you I want to thank the library again for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here, but I promised them a little while ago I would reserve most of the time for questions, and I really want to do that. So if you have questions, wave to the people, or I will point to you, and the people with the microphones will come down to you. Let's do this one first, and then this gentleman in the front over there. So we'll do you in the red, and then you right there. Go ahead. But wait for the microphone.
Thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia. Let me ask you this. How would you describe, in your words, the problems of character and or relationships in fiction or in nonfiction that most fascinate you?
Okay. That's a great question. The problems in character relationships that most fascinate me. And one of the reasons it's a great question is that, as I mentioned before, I usually start with my characters when I'm writing, and then I try to find a story in which I can tell their tales. There are 2 kinds of issues about character that fascinate me. I need to tell you, this is something else we came at dinner. I am, by conviction, a Christian. And what that means is that, among other things, I believe in the capacity for sin in all of us. Distinguishing sin from evil. We all have the capacity to fall short either of what God thinks we should do or what we think we should do. It's part of the human condition. And without sin, there'd be no serious fiction anyway. But I'm fascinated by people who have fallen short and are struggling somehow to get back to what they want or mean to be. And typically the protagonists of my novels are people of that description, people who somehow feel they've messed up their lives and they're trying to get their lives back to what they're supposed to be or trying to find something else. But the other thing that fascinates me is power, and a lot of my scholarship is about power. I'm interested in power, its uses, its abuses. The checks on it I'm interested in my scholarship, but really I'm one who deeply, deeply believes that checks on power for the most part are meaningless, that you can only try to build better people. There's really no other solution than that. There's no system so good that bad people can't ruin it. So I think that my novels all tend to focus on powerful people who are in some way abusing their power, and they tend to be opposed to the person who is my protagonist. The second thing is that I'm interested in family. I'm interested in family in a lot of different descriptions. I'm interested in the family and how people are shaped by their families. I was reading not long ago, some of you may know this, this work, that it turns out that when adults of every age hear a mother scolding a child, the part of the adult brain, even if they don't know the mother and the child, the part of the adult brain that lights up is the part that signals fear. It signals fear. It's really quite striking. Now, why that is, what it signifies, if it's natural, if it's learned, whatever it may be. And that fascinates me. That's the kind of detail that fascinates me. It fascinates me precisely because I am fascinated by family, by different kinds of family. My novel, Palace Council, was a family saga over a couple of generations. Somebody told me that all my characters have a domineering father or mother, or sometimes both. That's always in one of my novels. And they ask me, do I have a domineering father or mother? And not really. I think my father is Barbadian, and so there's a certain distance, I think, a traditional Barbadian, but not, I would say, domineering. And my mother was very gentle and warm, so not really. These are fictitious types, I think, that I'm interested in more than a reflection on my own upbringing.
How would you describe the difference between the process of writing your legal scholarship and writing fiction?
How would I describe the difference between the process of writing my legal scholarship and writing the fiction? Well, it's funny. I told someone in an interview yesterday that now that I've published 4 novels, I finally feel like a novelist. I want to say that. That is, until this year, I always described myself as a law professor who also wrote novels. And now I think of myself as a law professor and a novelist. But it's still harder for me to write fiction, much harder. The nonfiction, if not nonfiction isn't hard, it's that I have a process, I know how it works. Whether I'm writing a book or a scholarly article or an op-ed, I make an outline, I expand it, and I expand it some more, and then all of a sudden I'm done. It's keep expanding each point outward, and then you're finished. And I told the story before, I don't know if I've told it here before, but when I wrote my first novel, I tried to write it the same way. I tried to write an outline. I did write an outline. I took a lot of time over my outline. But I quickly discovered with that first novel that what some writers have described really came true. The characters kind of took over the story. That I'd get to chapter 5, and I couldn't get some character to do what they were supposed to do in the outline. This refused because the character basically said to me, but back in chapter 2, you gave me this character trait. You can't now take that away. And so I had that experience. I've had that with all of my novels. I always use an outline, and I can't stick to it with the same way that I can with my nonfiction. And a few years ago, my wife and I went to a book signing of a woman who writes novels, and she tends to turn them out when they're supposed to come out. And we got there late. We were sitting all the way in the back, and when it was question and answer, I asked one of the last questions, and I said, I heard you say earlier that you use an outline. She said, yes. And I said, do you ever find that the characters, she said, I said, do you ever find the characters take over the story somehow, and you have to discard the outline? And she said, no. And so I don't want to claim that my experience is universal. Let me just put it that way. There was somebody else over here before, right there in the blue T-shirt, right?
Your career sounds a little like Scott Turow's. I was wondering whether you've ever been compared to him.
I didn't hear the last part.
Have you ever been compared, or do you compare yourself to him?
Oh, I see what you mean. My career sounds like Scott Turow's. Have you ever been compared to him? Well, I'd be delighted to be compared to Scott Turow, I suppose, but that doesn't usually happen very much. I have met him a couple of times. Just been at programs together and things like that. I'm a great admirer. In fact, I've actually taught one of Scott Turow's novels in a course at Yale Law School. They tell you when you're going to promote your books, never talk about other people's books, but I don't mind doing that. I mean, he's a great thriller writer. I enjoy reading his stuff a lot. And so his book... I think it was his first novel, Presumed Innocent. I taught in a course. I teach a course at Yale on law secrets and lying, and I used that novel in that course. A lot of my courses, I use fiction, by the way. I assign a lot of novels. In fact, I taught a course this year entitled Ethics and Literature. It was actually a legal ethics course, but we read 8 novels and 4 plays. They read no legal ethics materials. I would each week give a lecture about legal ethics for an hour that would deal with issues in the book they just read for that week. And then we talk about the book itself and ethical issues that actually arose in the book. And that was a lot of fun. So I've used novels in a lot of my course, and then to do a course with just novels, and the students loved it. I got a big enrollment, which really surprised me. I thought it would be like 8 students, and it was more like 38 students, which for Yale, it's a really big course. And it's not, I realized that wouldn't impress anybody to decent-sized law school, but we have a dinky little law school. But in any case, the students really seem to enjoy that. And one of the things I like about Scott Turow's novels, actually, is they really do seem to be very seriously character-driven. In fact, some of them, like his novel, the one he wrote about Stanford, although he didn't call it Stanford, he gave it some other name,
The long one about Stanford was almost entirely character. There was the plot wasn't the key to that at all. It was really the characters and the memories. He taught at Stanford. When I was a student there, he was teaching at Stanford as a creative writing instructor, interestingly. So, are there questions on this side of the room? Well, while you go get the fellow all the way in the back, let's see who's on this side. This fellow right here has had his hand up for a while. Who has the microphone over here? I don't know where it is. Is there a microphone here? Oh, okay. This fellow right here, about five people in, we'll get next. So let's do this one. Yes.
Hello, Mr. Carter. This is Joseph.
Hello.
I'd like to thank you for coming to Philly, and because it seems like you're a very knowledgeable person and know a lot about things in the world. So
well,
I
try to fool my students into thinking so.
Yes. I have a kind of like serious question, like a two-parter.
Okay.
The book Jericho Fall has a lot of key plot points of Wall Street, CIA, global conspiracy, privileged money. Like, they're basically the major people in our society, in our world, and they seem to be the players in a big pawn game of chess that society is run by. And we really don't have a lot of people or anything that can really break their power. I mean, the book is a novel, but it really has a lot of serious life situations in it that I think that CIA, the Wall Street, and all these global conspiracies are part of. But being as you're a law professor, I would like to... the second part of the question would be, how can the laws be made to catch these people when they do wrong and get away with it? I mean,
okay, well, those are two very different points. I want to answer the second point, but first I answer the first. I think we slightly disagree in the following sense. All my novels, every single one of them revolves in some way around a deep conspiracy involving people in power. And because my novels revolve around that, people assume that I'm a conspiracy theorist, but actually I'm not. I'm quite the opposite. I honestly believe that most people, even in positions of great power, are simply not competent to carry out massive conspiracies. I honestly believe that, and it's not a left-right point. And I know too many of these people. You know, and I'm not saying they're not smart, but it's really hard to do a big conspiracy. Having said that, of course, conspiracies do happen. Terrible things do happen. The CIA has done bad things. The CIA has also done, I think, some very good things, and that shouldn't be overlooked either. People on Wall Street have done some bad things. They've also done very good things. I think creating prosperity is actually a very good thing. I'm actually writing an article now about why profit, for example, is important, why when corporations make record profits, they should be happy instead of angry. And especially now, I think we'd be delighted if there were some corporations around making some record profits. But as to the second part, here I think you're onto something very important. That is to say, it is a consistent theme in American society. It's been so for a long time that people have, all through history, that people have a sense that there are people out there, especially powerful people, get away with a lot of stuff that law doesn't catch. And that's absolutely true. It's got to be true. I do believe that. I'm not entirely sure how you fix that because there's always a trade-off. And the trade-off is between having perfect enforcement of the law and the amount of personal freedom you'd have to give up to have perfect enforcement of the law. So that's why there are these battles all the time over things like whether there should be cameras to catch people who run red lights. That's an example of that. So there's one camp that always says, why should people get away with running red lights if there's no cop around and so on, that people obey the law? And there's another camp that says there's a degree of freedom of pushing back of resistance that you need in order to live in a free society. And I think both sides have a point. I think that's the sort of thing we should be debating. I do think that one of the things that worries me a lot about the current moment is we clearly are having a lot of economic problems, although it's still not as severe as the recession of 81, 82, but we're still having a lot of economic problems. I think it is too early to be certain as to what the cause is, and a lot of people are rushing to fix it before we know exactly what happened. That can be very dangerous. The attack on Pearl Harbor took place in 1941. The definitive report of what happened and what went wrong came out in 1962. Sometimes it takes a very long time to be sure that you're right. I really do believe that when people engage in fraud and things like that, they should be put behind bars. I have no trouble with that at all. I think you and I would agree on that. But I don't know in any given case from the outside. I don't have any way of telling who did what, and I would rather that instead of being pushed to act fast by, say, the titans of cable news, which I think where the real power lies in American society, I think, sometimes, that we would take our time to make sure we get things right before deciding to act on them. Okay.
My turn? Over it.
Yes, your turn.
Is it on? Yes, it is on. Professor Carter, welcome.
Thank you.
To Philadelphia again. You speak to the inclination of men in power to seek solace.
I didn't say it was an inclination. I said it happens sometimes. And to make it very clear, I'm perfectly willing to believe that most men in power behave themselves.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm not a diplomat, nor am I a governor. And I keep hearing that the attitudes... Oh, I'm sorry. I keep hearing that the attitudes toward this sort of duplicity should someday start to relax here in the United States. Should relax here in the United States sometimes because, well, in Europe it seems more accepting. Who was it? Pompidou's wife and his mistress went to his funeral, I think. Is that true? Yeah. How's that going to impact your writing? If
well,
there's no longer the stigma.
Let me ask the hidden question. Let me answer the hidden question, not the actual question. I mean, the fact that something has happened in Europe is not evidence of whether it's right or wrong. You still have to evaluate whether it seems persuasive or not. I actually am more comfortable living in a system where it bothers us when people take vows and are unfaithful to them. And that's true whether it's a marriage vow or an oath of office or the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I mean, it bothers me when people make promises and then decide the promises don't mean anything so they can just go ahead and break them. It bothers me. And people tell me that's a very puritanical way of thinking, and maybe it is. I'm not saying that they're bad people if they do it. I'm saying it's perfectly all right to say there's something wrong with doing it. But then the question as put, it is certainly the case that if we as Americans decided that these various sexual peccadilloes, say, were unimportant and uninteresting, not only would it make it hard for me to write some of the kinds of novels that I write, but an awful lot of television news would cease to exist. Which might not be bad now that I think about it. It's this one here, and then right on the aisle up there.
Hi. You touched on the trade-off between personal freedoms and the opposite of cameras at stoplights. Could you comment on the prevalence of cameras all over England, Great Britain? They seem to be a free country, and they don't seem to find it too outrageous.
Sure. Well, the question is about the prevalence of cameras all over Britain. I've been there many times. I've never lived there. My daughter lived there for a while, and she liked it just fine. I can say that. But I want to emphasize. I think comparisons between America and Europe are always dangerous to make because the truth is that in spite of the fact we call ourselves together the West, the values of America and Europe are very different on a lot of sorts of issues. And so when we talk, so people, for example, talk about, depending on what side you're on, so people who are, say, liberals will talk about the European healthcare system, and people who are conservatives will talk about how in Europe they support religious schools with public money. I mean, none of that is evidence of anything. It's just a way of doing things. The question is each thing is a good or a bad way of doing things. So the question for me with respect to cameras, which may be a good idea or a bad idea, is not do people in Britain like it or not. The question is, would it work here? That seems to me, that's the question that interests me as policy. I told someone at dinner, politics bore me. Elections I hate. I don't like politics. And by and large, I don't care who wins. I just don't. But policy interests me greatly. I'm interested in the actual output of government. And the output of government is policy. That's the only output it has. And that's what interests me. I'm interested in the details of policy, and culture and policy are deeply intertwined. Simply winning an election doesn't dictate policy because there are cultural impediments and also cultural imperatives that lead, that press against oppress in favor of certain kinds of policies. This is a fact of living in a complicated country. And so what interests me is policy and the output of government, and I think questions like that are the right one. If we have a debate about cameras and stoplights, I like to be a real debate, not bumper stickers. This is my books versus bumper stickers point. I like actual argument where people think about what they're saying, think about what the other side is saying, and actually try to get a grip on things. I think that when we reduce things to applause lines and bumper stickers and slogans, that's reactionary. That's a reactionary way of doing politics. And it doesn't matter whether one thinks of oneself on the left or on the right. It is simply reactionary to take the view that the only reason someone could disagree with me is because they're either evil or they're idiots. There's no third. It cannot. My view of the world is basically this. There are some issues that have only one side, but it's a very small list of issues. Most issues that divide us deeply divide us precisely because there are good arguments on both sides. That's why people take different sides of them, not because one side is stupid or evil, because there are good arguments on both sides. Now, I admit that's not a very popular view, especially around election time, but that's why I don't like elections, you see. That's the reason. I like elections in the past. I'm a student of the past. I always tell my students always get very exercised about the next election, you know, whatever. It's always the most important election in American history. And I tell them, no, 1864 was the most important election in American history. I said, I will prove it to you. We go through all the explanation of why it was. There's nothing, no other election has been close. The next close was 1860. That was the second most important election in American history, I tell them. And the third most important was 1876, and they have no idea what happened in 1876. And I tell them, if you don't know the answer to those, then you cannot possibly tell me that this is the most important election in history. So, but that's, you know, I'm a professor. I have to say things like that. What can I tell you? I'm right there, yes.
Professor Carter, I'm only going to refer to your fiction. Is there a movie?
Is there a
in
movie?
Is there going to be a movie in the works?
Oh, I see what you're asking.
Nonfiction, of course.
You're not asking about the movie rights to my book, Civility, Manners, Morals, and the Etiquette of Democracy. That's not them. We sold the movie rights for my first novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park. We didn't sell the second one because we didn't like the deal. We're in negotiations for the third novel, Palace Council. And this novel we haven't offered for sale yet. Now, is there going to be a movie? Well, the problem is, even if you sell the movie rights, Hollywood buys a lot of books they never make. I don't know. They bought the movie rights to The Emperor of Ocean Park before it came out. They bought the movie rights in 2001, when the novel wasn't even finished yet. And as far as I know, unless I missed it, they haven't made a movie yet. So I try not to worry about that part. I mean, it is true that if you sell your book to Hollywood, it's more lucrative if they make the movie than if they don't make the movie. That's certainly true. But it's pretty good if they don't make the movie, too, actually. It's okay. So my agent says, you know, take the money and run when they do that. And that's my view of searching. So they made a movie, great. If they don't, you know. Well, it's funny, though. I had dinner with John Grisham, and they say don't talk about other people's books, but he doesn't need me to endorse his books to sell books, so that's okay. So I did know John Grisham a couple months ago, and he says to me, you know, he said the secret of my success, he said, had nothing to do with my writing. It had to do with the fact that three movies of my books came out in 18 months of each other. And the people who were in those movies, you know, Tom Cruise, Denzel Washington, Julia Roberts, he said, that's what made my career. He said, so before that I was a pretty good selling writer. After that I was a big selling writer. So that was what made the difference. So we'll see. We'll see. Okay, over here, all the way in the back there. And then we'll get, there was someone in front who has been very patient. Yes, over there. Yes, the gentleman right there, three rows back. First we'll do this one, then we'll do you. Okay.
Hi, Professor Carter. I have a question also about your fiction as far as how do you build suspense and sustain suspense?
How do I build suspense and sustain suspense? Well, I can't give away my secrets, you know. But it does help to end chapters with things like, you know, the end of chapter that one I just read you, and then there's chapter 2 or chapter 3, which ends with the next day she found the headless dog. You know, you kind of want to, oh, okay, and then you want to turn the page. I mean, I do,
I do have fun with the ends of my chapters. I admit, I really do, and I always have. When I wrote my first novel, I did not sit down to write a thriller. I was just trying to tell the stories of these people. I realized that the story was turning into one, and that's when I started fiddling around with the ends of my chapters. And I do try to fiddle with that a little bit, and that certainly helps. But I think there's something else. I think in a successful thriller, there's three ingredients that you need. You need a protagonist that the reader cares about. If the reader doesn't care about the protagonist, you're shot. You need a larger force at work that the protagonist has to unravel, usually with either no or very little help. And most important, nobody can believe her. Right? Maybe somebody does, but basically people don't believe what she thinks or he thinks is happening. You have to have that. So it has to be a protagonist people actually like, and they care what happens to that person. There has to be this malevolent force, and people don't believe it. That's those are the ingredients. And you have those ingredients to add some cliffhangers, and you've thrown a couple of car chases, and you've got a and you've got a thriller. Beyond that, I don't want to say anything. Right there.
Thank you, Professor Carter. I enjoyed Ocean Park and New England White. And I have a question about New England White, and it has to do with...
You're not going to give away any of the mystery, are you?
An organ... Well, I hope not.
No, wait a minute. If you're going to give away the mystery, you need to ask me after we're done.
Well, all right, well, you'll be the judge from the question. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Okay. There's an organization in New England White called the Imperials.
Yes.
And I wonder, is that based on anything at all other than your own imagination?
Oh, I see. Well, New England White, I did write in part as a kind of homage to some of the black social organizations. And the social organizations, the fraternities, the sororities, some of the private clubs, have an importance still in the African-American community that I think other people sometimes don't appreciate, except at a great distance, the amount of networking that goes on, the connections one makes, and the actual importance they have to the people in them. And so with both the organization I created in that book, the Imperials, which was a men's organization, and Ladybugs, which was a women's organization, they're not based on anything in particular, but they are meant to capture some of the flavor of those organizations.
Well, I was particularly interested...
Now I think you're getting towards something you don't want to talk about. I can tell from the way
you're asking. The purpose of the Imperials...
Yes.
Which was to collect information.
Now you got to stop there. You have to stop. You have to stop. I keep telling you.
Fair enough.
You
okay.
Cannot say any more.
Fair enough. Okay.
So let's just say you asked. Well, let's stick with the first one you asked. Okay. Now there was someone over here, and then we'll get before you. I want to get this other gentleman here in the yellow. Wasn't there someone over here? Okay, maybe not. Let's get the gentleman in the yellow here then.
Could you talk about the extent to which the character of Talcott Garland in The Emperor of Ocean Park is autobiographical, and how your own experience as a law professor informed the experience of Mr. Garland?
Thank you for asking that question. I'm happy to clear up that common misunderstanding. Let me make something, as Richard Nixon said, perfectly clear. Richard Nixon, as you know, is a character in my book, Palace Council. Talcott Garland is not autobiographical. A lot of people assume, since my narrator of my first novel was a black law professor, it had to be based on me. But writing Talcott's personality was very difficult for me. It was very hard to sustain that voice. I want to believe that I am not like him. I found him, he has a lot of redeeming qualities, and I really loved the way he thinks about his son, for example, but he struck me as in certain ways, to lack of a better word, whiny, I think I would say. He could be very sweet, but he could also be very possessive, and he had all this anger that was not directed anywhere. He constantly felt he was excluded from things and so on. That character was not meant to be a model of me. It's just a character I came up with. I wrote him in law school because at the time that's what I knew best. But he wasn't meant to be me any more than, say, LeMaster Carlyle, the president of the university in the next novel, who's also black, wasn't meant to be me. Was a very different kind of character, wasn't meant to be me either. Of course, pardon me, my personal experiences inform my. This is like being in front of the Senate committee, isn't it? Of course, my personal experiences inform my writing, but I would like to believe. that a good white writer and a good black writer could write the same story. Seriously, it's interesting because, it's been an interesting problem in fiction, actually. One of the reasons it might matter more than I want it to, whether my character, Beck, is white or black in the mind of the reader, is there are a lot of people who think that if you're black, you shouldn't write a white character. You should just write black characters. If you're a man, you shouldn't write women and so on and so on. And I don't believe that. I think that defeats the project of human communication. It suggests that we cannot understand anyone but ourselves. I think we actually often understand better people better than we understand ourselves. We understand ourselves, in my experience, very, very poorly. In any case, I think it is fundamental to living in a diverse society to try to understand a lot of different ways of looking at the world. And if I can represent different ways in my fiction, I count that a very small but significant victory. How about this? I think this is the only hand that's up, right? Right here.
Thank you. You talked earlier about the different styles that you use to write your scholarly works and your fiction. What drove you or perhaps inspired you to write the first book, the fiction?
First novel, you mean?
Yes.
Well, it is true that I wanted to write fiction from the time I was very small. I've told the story before that when I was a little boy growing up in Washington, D.C., I used to buy these little spiral notebooks at we lived a block from the elementary school, and there was a little store on the way home, and I would stop at the store sometimes and buy these little spiral notebooks. I'm talking about when I was in third and fourth grade, and the spiral notebooks had 8 pages. And they had these lines, and they were small notebooks, about this big. And I would write what I called my stories. I would buy them with my allowance on Friday. I'd spend the weekend writing a story. The story would begin on page 1. It would end on page 8. There were usually no paragraph breaks. There wasn't much punctuation. And the stories were, dinosaurs take over the earth, and they are defeated by a plucky little boy from Washington, D.C. Aliens take over the earth, and they're defeated by a plucky little boy from Washington, D.C., that kind of thing. I always wanted to write fiction. And all the years in high school and college, I was always writing short stories for literary magazines, things like that. And I've always taken jobs where I can write, whether the extracurricular activities I did in college and law school, the jobs I've had. Being a law professor is wonderful because I get to write and write all kinds of different things. But I always wanted to write fiction. And there's a box in our bedroom at home. And my wife often reminds me, this it's a moving box. It's one of those brown boxes. We've carried around from house to house. And it has in it these pieces of novels. I started typing right when I got out of law school, an old IBM Selectric typewriter. And my wife's question is, why does it have to be in the bedroom all the time? You never open it. I haven't opened the box in years. But I always have a sense that it needs to be nearby. It's a very weird, mystical connection with this box. These bits and pieces of novels, I think if you ever read them, and nobody ever will, but if you ever read them and you'd read my novels, you would recognize characters from most of my novels in their early stages of development in these pages and pages, thousands of pages of efforts to write novels before. What happened was I finally found a story worthy of some of the characters. That's how the first novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, came about. The more practical story of how it came about is I've been fiddling around with it a lot over the years. My literary agent, who handles my nonfiction work, had seen like 10 or 12 pages of it once. And it was December, I think, of 2000. I was sitting in my literary agent's office talking about the project I wanted to do next. I wanted to do this big book about education. And we were talking about that, and she said, why don't you finish your novel instead? And we talked about that and finally decided to give that a try, and that's what became The Emperor of Ocean Park. I still have to finish that book about education, though. I haven't gotten back to doing that yet. Now there's a question right there.
Hi, Professor Carter. I'm a bit embarrassed. I've only read your nonfiction work, Culture of Disbelief. I think Affirmative Action Baby years ago. But I wanted to have a question. I heard you talk about sin, and I'm curious in terms of how you're imagining, why you're so fascinated with sin, and how then does that play a role in your character development? And
how does it play a role in my what?
In your character development. Mm-hmm. And why not say focus on love? Because it seems like there's a lot of focus on sort of individual sort of virtues, certain kind of practices that sort of shape the person. I'm curious in terms of the tension between, say, culture and sort of and mm-hmm. sin or individual sin.
No, I see what you're asking. Let me say two things. One is that sin is not identical to vice. And it's at least in Orthodox Christianity, sin and vice are not the same thing. It's an important distinction to make. Sin is the human condition. It's the condition of fallen, broken human beings. Sin is the gap. Sin is the inability to realize our best selves. It's what all of us are and what we do. It is our existence. I do believe in love, and my novels do talk about that. And part of what I believe about it is actually what Talcott Garland, the first novel, quotes his father as saying, that love is first and foremost not a feeling but an activity. It is a discipline and a decision. And that may be part of why I react so strongly, say, when people break their marriage vows and things like that, that it's not simply a matter of feeling, it's a matter of discipline. It's a matter of deciding, I think, what to do. Margaret Farley, the brilliant Roman Catholic theologian, has written a lot about the importance of understanding the Greek roots of the word decision, meaning, if you think about it, decision, to cut off. A decision is a cutting off of other options. And her view is that promises and vows aren't just words. They're decisions. They're cutting off the option of not doing that thing. The reason it's important to think about love as a discipline is when we think about it that way, it helps us understand why it's important to have a sense of what we should do. You and I may disagree on what we should do, but each of us individuals should have a sense of the should as opposed to a sense of simply following whatever our desire is of the moment. And it's not a matter of me telling you what you should do or you telling me what I should do. It's you telling you what you should do, and to understand that should, following that should, is a discipline. It's an important one. And none of us can do it all the time. I fall short all day long, every day. But it's the aspiration that's important. The aspiration to love others, to love the neighbor, is first and foremost a matter not of how we feel or think about the neighbor, but how we act toward the neighbor, whatever our feelings might be. This ties in with what I said before about books and bumper stickers, you see, that part of loving our neighbor is loving a neighbor across the differences that we might have. I was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, one of the great human beings I've ever known, one of the great justices as well. And I got to know him a lot better in the last year of his life because retired justices, he only lived a little more than a year after retiring, retired justices do oral history projects for the Federal Judicial Center, and he asked me to be his interviewer for his oral history. And we recorded about 35 hours before he died. We didn't finish, but we got the more important part. We didn't get to the Supreme Court. We got up to when he was nominated, and then we just ran out of time. He got sick. But the more fascinating part of his life is the life before the court. A lot of people now who say they adore him and miss him, they really mean they miss his vote on the Supreme Court. But the human being that was Marshall, shaped by the experiences when he was litigating civil rights cases and criminal cases all over the country, often at great personal risk, literally fleeing for his life from lynch mobs, usually for little or no money as well. And I tell you all that as the prelude to a point. I never heard him say a bad word about anyone. He would speak of, well, I'll give you an example. Thurgood Marshall was the lead lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund who argued Brown against the Board of Education, and of course he won. At the time of the case, the states who wanted to segregate hired as their lawyer John W. Davis, viewed at the time of my man as the greatest appellate advocate in America. He also was a former presidential candidate. He was a Wall Street lawyer. He was an old Virginia and West Virginia gentleman. He was also a segregationist. And so I once asked Justice Marshall what he thought of John W. Davis. And I thought he would heap hellfire and damnation on his head, which is what I would have done, being 25, 26 years old and therefore knowing everything there is to know, pretty much. But I've always remembered his answer. He said, without missing a beat, he said, John W. Davis, a good man, a great man, who just happened to believe in segregation. He was not being facetious. This was the way I always heard him talk about people. He would look across what I think most of us would consider the greatest moral divide in America in the 20th century and look at the people on the other side and say, they're not monsters, they're just wrong. They're just misguided. But they're not monsters, they're not the enemy, they're simply my opponents. And he was actually on pretty good terms, as it turned out, with some of the great segregationist governors and mayors and senators of the day, and he would tell stories about sitting around, and this hasn't made it into any of the biographies. One woman's biography touches on it, but not very much. He would sit around in back rooms. He would tell the stories, sit around in back rooms, as he would say, playing cards and drinking whiskey with these various segregationists to make a deal to avoid litigation, to avoid a demonstration, to avoid action on the other side by the Klan or something. And the highest praise he would pay, he would say, you could do business with him. He believed in the handshake. He believed in people keeping their word. That, to me, is an exemplar of loving the neighbor. That is, he, across that divide, could actually feel affection for some of these people, understanding them, and therefore he could work with them, even as he opposed with every fiber of his being what they stood for. I think we could do with more people in that model. And on that note, I think I should stop. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.